It's been quite a fortnight. Sham elections, a vicious terror attack, and frankly, pretty vicious state response. And speaking personally, broadband outages and emergency dental surgery. So, I don't want to touch all that, and I don't want to do the obvious. So instead, what else but sex, drugs, and rock and roll? Well, kinda. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Now, I trust the more astute listeners will have already worked out that I'm engaged in a shabby game of bait and switch. Let me start. Sex. Well, sex is in itself, in some ways, a sexier way of saying demographics. Look, the Russian demographic problem is sometimes very much overblown, especially this idea that somehow Putin is going to run out of soldiers anytime soon. And yes, although Russia is facing a problem, we also have to recognise it's not always that much worse than many other European countries, including, not least, Ukraine, where there really is facing something of a disaster, not just due to the 6+ million Ukrainians who've fled the country. At the end of last year, Russia had 146.2 million people living permanently there. And that's down from the 1993 peak of 149 million. Now, why the decline? To a large extent, it's the sort of familiar types of tales that you'd also find in the West. In other words, a pretty flat level of natural population growth since about 2000. It means, in other words, overall deaths have largely outnumbered births. Last year, there were only 1.27 million babies born, which is the lowest number since 2000. And to a considerable extent, that's due not to down to declining fertility or interest in sex or whatever, but really rather about the shrinking cohort of people, you know, young adults aged 25 to 30, peak at their fertility, which is now about 5 million smaller than it was a decade ago. And look, the number of births is expected to stay at around the current low level, at least until the end of this decade. And at the same time, of course, the Russian population is, again, like European, Western countries, it's greying, it's getting older. And if you look at the latest population forecasts from Rostat, the Russian statistics agency, which frankly is pretty accurate and on the ball, well, their forecast imagines that the pension age share of the population is going to go up from at present, which is 24%, to around 27% in the 2040s. So that also raises the question of, you know, who works and who pays for the largely economically inactive pensioners, who also, needless to say, have higher medical needs. The mortality rate, which is deaths per 1,000 people per year, has also fallen throughout the past two decades. Now, again, obviously, COVID and now the war have their own specific sort of bites out of the population pyramid. But generally speaking, you know, we can recognise that, in fact, Russians are getting healthier and the overall lifespan of Russians generally has increased, though by nowhere near enough to make up for the declining births. Now, this big issue has actually been highlighted recently by none other than Kirill, Patriarch of Moscow and all the Rus, and certainly one of Putin's most assiduous fanboys. Remember, this is the man who famously called Putin a miracle of God. Anyway, he is, of course, committed to Putin's project, from the tip of his shoes to the crucifix on top of his headdress. Just here, I've got to have a little sidebar on that. I don't know if you've seen pictures of him, but it's, you know, a big rounded headdress with a little crucifix on top. That crucifix folds flat to allow him to get in and out of his luxury limos. And footage of him doing that shows that a flunky rushes up to fold it for him and then unfold it for him when he gets out the car. Now, I found myself wondering,
Is this just an ad hoc duty of whoever happens to be nearby, or is there a dedicated folder of the patriarchal head cross? I think we should be told. Anyway, recently, at the same time as he was calling the war in Ukraine, sorry, the special military operation, you know, a holy war, a sacred one, he went back to this sort of classic point about the need for Russia to repopulate itself, which he connected to the idea of, you know, the traditional family values, and also an updated migration policy, though he was a bit woolly on that, and more on that in a moment. And he labelled this issue, the demographic crisis, as Russia's main existential threat. So he actually very much put it in security terms, and therefore the need for actual reversing the current trend and increasing the population. By how much? Well, here he went into absolutely barking mad territory, in that, in his view, Russia should aim that over the next century, it will grow its population to 600 million people, which is essentially trebling it. And how do you imagine that this extraordinary task can be accomplished? Well, he talked about the revival of the traditional large family supported by traditional family values, which is something that Putin himself has, well, he has certainly sort of talked about, though one can question the traditional values at the heart of Putin's little menage. And, you know, Putin declared that 2024 was going to be the year of the family. And there's been all kinds of different moves now to try and bring financial benefits and the like to encourage people to have large families, but also to ensure that the government provides the necessary support, therefore. Now, in this case, we had Kirill saying that actually popular culture, which more anon, should create what he called a cult of the family in society, and suggested all kinds of economic benefits that the state should introduce in order to encourage large families, because after all, nothing says romantic love quite like a tax break. Now, as I say, this is absolute nonsense. There is no way that you can treble the population of Russia. It goes against all the usual dynamics of a developed economy. This is the bottom line, actually. In this respect, Russia is a victim of relative economic success, which tends to lead to people not thinking quite so much about large numbers of families, not thinking that they have to have more kids because, A, some of them are going to die in childbirth and the like, and therefore you need spares, and B, because these are the kids are the only force on whom you can rely for survival and in your old age. No, now we have healthcare systems and pension systems and the like. So how does he imagine, though, that this could possibly work? I mean, for a start, where would they live? Are we talking about a continued sprawl of Moscow? Or, well, I mean, the only real answer one could give, actually, interestingly, was the notion that Defence Minister Sergei Shoigu had. There was a point before the invasion when money was still around, and I think Shoigu was thinking about his next step before he got stuck in this miserable position as being Defence Minister. Is, I think he was thinking himself as the next presidential plenipotentiary to the Siberian Federal District, but particularly with, remember, Shoigu is by training background a builder, with the kind of budgets that would allow him to basically build new cities, and in the process open up Siberia in a way that frankly it never has. You know, a couple of strands of railway do not suddenly rebuild it. Arguably the closest we got to the real opening up of Siberia was with the Gulag labour camps, and I don't think that's an example that even today's Russia really is thinking about. Now, that was very much Shoigu's dream, and to be honest, a really interesting one. And who knows if actually that had been brought to some kind of fruition, whether it would lead anywhere. I suspect not, because remember, Putin had all kinds of massive opportunities to redevelop Russia, to reorient it away from hydrocarbons, and generally to build a new Russia in the 2000s and very early 2010s, when he had the money and the political freedom to do so. He did not do it then, so he's, I think, much less likely to do it now. But still, that is one theoretical future. Apart from that, though, there's no real sense of quite where these people would live. And it's not just about that. It's about how are you going to pay for those tax breaks to encourage people to have more kids? Yes, sure. But also for the infrastructure that a large population is going to need. The schools, the hospitals, the homes, the roads, the railways, everything. I do not imagine that in the immediate future, regardless of what happens in Ukraine, Russia will be quite so overspilling with cash that it'll be looking to invest money in that. Frankly, it needs to actually reinvest in crumbling infrastructure already, even before it starts thinking about building others. Now, let's be honest also. Clearly, Putin, who has two daughters by his first wife, Lyudmila, may have one more daughter with his rumoured girlfriend, Alina Kabaeva. And, again, even more rumoured, is that he might have had a daughter with a mistress of his from the late 1990s, one Svetlana Krivonogich. Well, with four kids, surely he's showing the way. But the point is, again, it doesn't work that way. What does work is, of course, migration. And so far, what we have seen is the declining population trend for Russia has, to a considerable extent, been offset by a net influx of people, largely from Central Asia. Remember, if you're in Central Asia, or large parts of Central Asia, Russians have it pretty damn good. And actually, this is a definite step up. So if one looks at official records, and frankly, official records probably substantially understate the issue, they show that, for example, last year there was net immigration of more than 200,000 people. 200,000 may not sound all that much, but nonetheless, it's about half of the natural population decline. And the assessment is that without significant numbers of immigrants, as well as the sort of fake increase in population by the occupied territories, Russia's population would actually have shrunk by about 5 million over the past 10 years. And in addition to that, there is a huge amount of temporary labour. So again, especially from some Central Asia. Now, according to the Bank of Finland's Institute for Emerging Economies, which is a very, very good source of data on what's going on in Russia, in January to September of 2023, roughly 3.6 million people entered Russia for work, which is back to pre-pandemic levels. And that may, again, be something of an underestimate, because the point is a lot of people, they travel back and forth, they sort of, you know, they may settle, they may not settle, but you know they actually sort of regard seasonal work in Russia as a part of your sort of annual economic cycle, shall we say. So 3.6 million, about 45% coming from Uzbekistan, about 28% from Tajikistan, and perhaps rather unfairly, say, including potentially for terrorists, and 14% from Kyrgyzstan. Now, that's well and good, and these are indeed absolutely essential to a labour market that is overstretched at the moment. I mean, unemployment is basically down to fractional levels. The pressure of the war, the demands of the defence sector and so forth, all of which means that Russia actually doesn't have enough workers. So absolutely crucial, and that's why it's all the more serious about the backlash that's coming from the current sort of atmosphere created by the terrorist incident. Yeah, and I know, I was hoping not to be able to talk about these recent things, but there's no way you can get away from them. Interestingly, it's the Tajik Ministry of Labour which has particularly noted that there's been a large number of their citizens who apparently have been getting in touch, wanting to leave Russia, or not so much actually wanting to get out right now, but in some ways wanting to find out what the situation is, because they do feel that concerns about domestic discrimination in Russia have gone up. And, yeah, we hear all kinds of anecdotal stuff about people sort of, you know, checking, is my taxi driver Tajik? No. Well, yes, if he is, then please cancel the call, that kind of thing. So one of the things we're going to have to watch is precisely whether or not we get the kind of Kremlin-led or society-led discriminatory backlash following the terrorist incident, which means a lot of these Central Asians decide to go home, and more to the point, Central Asians who may well have been considering going to Russia decide to look for alternatives. And in any case, I'm not entirely convinced that the Patriarch was actually thinking, when he talked about the need to expand Russia's population, about just how good it would be to have lots more Muslims from Central Asia coming into the country. Probably not, but then, you know, maybe I'm underestimating him. But when we talk about underestimating him, I mean, we also have to note clearly that his extraordinary powers. I mean, back in 2012, remember, Kirill was accused of once turning up wearing a Swiss Breguet watch worth over £200,000. And in an interview with, of course, the toxic propagandist Vladimir Solovyov, Kirill said that, he may have been given one as a gift, but he'd never worn it. Except that then photographs on his official website turned up showing him what seemed to be him wearing this extraordinarily expensive watch on his left wrist. And then a later one showed a miracle, because the watch itself had disappeared, but still was visible in the reflection on the table's shiny surface. Yes, obviously this was just a clumsy attempt at airbrushing, but it did lead to the entertaining moment when in June of that year, June 2012, Kirill was given the so-called Silver Shoe Award, which is actually a Russian tongue-in-cheek award given for the most dubious achievements in show business. I mean, I love the fact that it was both recognizing that the patriarch was actually in show business as much as anything else, but also, you know, that showing this a dubious achievement because, in their words, he demonstrated his capacity for the immaculate disappearance of a watch, and it was in the category miracles up to the elbow. So maybe he's actually planning on another miracle to reverse this demographic trend. But maybe he's not. Okay, so let's move on from sex to drugs. And yes, I will be talking about drugs. Of the prescription pharmaceutical variety. Now, actually Russia, like many other places with considerable socialised healthcare, as well as thanks to a pretty liberal, almost neoliberal economic model, actually has not only extraordinary availability of pharmaceutical products, and let me be honest, I think worryingly so. There are all kinds of drugs which certainly in the UK you would need to get a doctor's prescription for, but that you can buy over the counter in Russia. So that's one immediate sort of warning. But also that often, you know, if you compare it to other countries, it's relatively cheap. And even ironically enough, Joe Biden inadvertently indicated this when he was talking on, I think it was the State of the Union. Anyway, he said, "Folks, I'm going to get in trouble for saying it, but anyone who could get in Air Force One and fly with me to Toronto, Berlin, Moscow, even Moscow probably, and bring your prescription with you, and I promise you I'll get it for you 40% of the cost you're paying now. Same company, same drug, same place." Now, you know, by the standards of Biden gaffes, that was a relatively benign one, because although he probably didn't actually intend to exalt the values of the Russian pharmaceutical market, nonetheless, actually, it is perfectly true. Now, though, and really we have since the imposition of sanctions, it is clear that there are definite issues with access to vital drugs. And although it's not because these medicines are under sanction, quite the opposite, they're given exemptions. But in some ways, that's a bit disingenuous. With the massive disruptions to the supply chains, with the problems in basically being able to actually pay for anything, courtesy of all the obstacles on bank-to-bank transfers and the like. And indeed, come to think of it, the amount of red tape that is now about around getting those exemptions for this kind of export. The problem is that some companies just simply don't want to bother with the Russian market anymore, or feel that it leaves them potentially exposed. So it's actually the case that there is a real squeeze on some particular medicines in the Russian market at a time when there's growing demand for at least some of them. I mean, it's perhaps quite telling that antidepressant sales in Russian pharmacies have hit a five-year high in the early months of 2024. Now, look, in part, this is because doctors are increasingly prescribing antidepressants instead of the kind of sedatives and tranquilizers that might well be used back in Soviet times, which was distinctly more medieval. But the point is, that's not actually all it. It's also that there is a genuine need. Russian pharmacies sold in the first 11 weeks of this year 3.6 million packs of antidepressants. 3.6 million. Now, how's the trend been? Well, interestingly, last year it was just 2.7 million packs. The year before, Same period in 2022, so in other words, covering the actual initial period of the invasion of Ukraine, it was actually up at 3.3 million packs and just 1.8 million in 2021 and 2022. So, in other words, you have less than 2 million being sold before the invasion. When the invasion happens, you have a sudden spike in people, I don't know, presumably thinking, oh my God, what's happening? Is this World War III? What the hell has happened? Are our leaders have all gone insane? When there is a sudden spike, then in some ways, as things begin to feel a little bit normalized, the worst has not necessarily happened. 2023 is, up from the pre-war levels, but a little bit down from the immediate invasion one. But now, remember, at a time when I think people are realizing that basically the war is now their reality for the foreseeable future, it's gone up again. So that's not only an interesting insight into the psyche of the Russian people, and I think this is just a little sideline point here as well. One of the problems that people have is, can we still study Russia now that we're no longer necessarily, in many cases, able to travel there, and we're not able to use certain amounts of data and this, that, and the other, and more sort of sources are being closed off to us. Well, actually, one of the ways in which we're doing it is precisely by looking at alternative indices that may tell us something. You can only read so much into antidepressant purchases. But on the other hand, as one indicator among many, in the way we triangulate what's going on, I think actually this is where the really interesting research is going to be, finding clever, subtle, sideways means of assessing what's going on. Anyway, that was just a little sort of observation. So, yes, there is an issue. There are certain demands, but there is also squeezes on access to either some whole categories of drugs or some very, very specific ones. I mean, certain insulin products, for example, are under particular pressure, especially as Russian production can still not catch up with the decline in import access. Specific example, last year, for example, the healthcare watchdog Rostradnadzor said that the American pharmaceutical company Merck was halting supplies of very sort of widely used hepatitis C medicine and had already stopped providing something, I can't remember what it's called now, anyway, a medicine which reduced the chances that HIV would actually develop into full-blown AIDS. So there are these kind of specific drugs which are no longer accessible. The Russian Ministry of Health is trying to deny that there is a medicine shortage. But interestingly, when it says that the domestic pharmaceutical market is stable, actually, when you look more deeply, it is implicitly admitting that domestic pharmaceutical production has not yet ramped up to the relevant level. And this is not something where autarky, in other words, simply relying on your own production, is at all possible. Again, according to the Ministry of Health, last year, in total, 6 billion packages of medicines were released into civilian circulation. And of those 6 billion, 4 billion were produced in Russia. Well, the question becomes, what about the other two? So, what does this actually mean? Well, first of all, I mean, I think it's fair to say, unwanted and unexpected impact of the sanctions regime. And it's one that is also, I would suggest, has from the first generated quite a strong backlash, even amongst Russians who are actually very critical of Putin and the war. I mean, not just from personal anecdotal example. I know that people, it's all very well thinking that, in fact, Russia has done wrong. But when, for example, your kid can't get the medicines that he or she needs because the pharmacy doesn't have it, you are actually much more likely, in my experience, to blame the West rather than to blame Putin. Yes, that's not necessarily fair or right, but there you go. So, I mean, I think it is worth noting. I think this is one of the areas where, given that the West did not want to actually have an impact on the supply of medicines to ordinary Russians, we might have thought a little bit more carefully about the knock-on effects of the wider sanctions regime. In response, though, it obviously means a growing use of smuggling. Again, every time you ban something, you create a market for criminals. Doesn't necessarily mean you don't ban things. I guess there's a whole debate about, Class A drugs and the like. But nonetheless, one has to recognise that, criminals will find ways of monetizing those deficits. And so this is definitely what's happening. You know, gangs which once upon a time, their idea of drug smuggling meant getting Afghan heroin into Europe. Now their idea of smuggling is also, I mean, unfortunately, it's not that they give up on the drugs, the heroin, but it's also on the way back, finding ways of, smuggling difficile, particular drugs, especially the kind of named ones that people might want, back into Russia. And we even have product piracy now being conducted with the open blessing of the state. For example, there's now this diabetes drug, Ozempic, that is also widely touted as a weight loss one and therefore has a certain, alternative market. Anyway, it can now be produced and sold on the Russian market without the consent of the Danish pharmaceutical company that actually produced it by an act of the Russian government. They have decided that basically they're perfectly fine with their own companies ignoring copyright or patents or whatever it is that actually sort of drugs have. So I think this is it. Increasingly, we're seeing this kind of creeping criminalization of the process, both as organized crime smuggles things in, but also as the state itself decides to turn a blind eye to breaches in international understandings and laws in order just simply to meet the needs of its domestic market. And finally, this also ties into geoeconomics. Where are the Russians turning to? Well, once upon a time, their main source was Germany. Now that's been overtaken by India. You know, Indian manufacturers generally are increasing their exports to Russia. But in particular, actually, India has now overtaken the West as the leading supply of pharmaceuticals. So in this respect, it closes the gap between Russia and India, particularly because one of the issues for the Russians has actually up to now been that they export so much more to Russia than they import, and frankly, they can't really work out what to do with the money that their exports to Russia nets, both because of the problems in transferring money and also because of the currency in which it is. So in some ways, the more that actually India can export to Russia, the more it helps address that particular problem. And generally speaking, it also closes this kind of very, very pragmatic, but nonetheless relationships, even to the point of alliances that one can see between Russia and countries such as India, who up to this point were largely locked out of certain sectors of the Russian economy, precisely because the West, or Europe in particular, had something of a comparative advantage. But with Europe and the West essentially having decided to forego that advantage, just as in some cases it's handing markets to criminals, in this particular case it is handing markets to its competitors worldwide, such as, for example, India. So that's the sex, that's the drugs. Let's have a break and see what I'm going to shoehorn under the overall category of rock and roll.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
Now, call me self-interested or maybe even self-indulgent, but I think under rock and roll, we can talk generally about Russian music and indeed about other forms of Russian culture. And what really sparked this was thinking more about a scoop by a media consortium, groups like V Square and Delphi in Estonia and so forth, leaks of materials from the presidential administration, specifically from the domestic political bloc of Sergei Kiryenko. And it included lots of spreadsheets about expenditures. And a lot of that was pretty much what you'd expect. There was a considerable focus on programs which could help build up a new elite, identifying, you know, mayors who really could, should be fast-tracked for further development and that kind of thing. But also there was clearly a strong emphasis on what we could think of as cultural political operations, intended for domestic use to try and mobilise the minds of Russians behind the war and behind Putin's kind of nation-building project more generally. Because this is Kirienko's job, and I also think, frankly, it's Kirienko's passion. I do believe increasingly that he thinks of himself as, to use a Stalinist term, an engineer of the human soul. He's out there to retune the Russians to becoming a population that is more in line with what the Kremlin needs. And in part, this is about addressing music. Now, I'm not saying, for example, that Kirienko specifically is directly behind it, but, you know, one can witness the rise of a whole new generation of sort of turbo patriot musicians. The classic example being so-called Shaman, the performer who became particularly famous for his sort of anthem, Yaruski, I Am Russian, with that particular line, I'm Russian to spite the whole world. And although patrons were, I hesitate to say treated, but shall I say exposed to it, in one of my sort of 12 days of shadowy Christmas sort of bonuses around the Christmas period, I will include a link to one of his videos in the programme notes for those of you who have strong stomachs and as well as a strong sense of curiosity. So, you know, Shaman is very much was brought front and centre, for example, in the presidential election campaign, and is an attempt to basically make a government full of grey old men somehow look sexy. But he's not the only one. I mean, for example, there's Yulia Chicherina, who is sometimes described as a sort of Vera Lynn of the Russian front line. She often goes and does sort of impromptu little sort of guitar concerts for soldiers on the front lines. She's actually willing to go and, well, you know, get pretty damn close to the trenches in a way that Shaman, to the best of my knowledge, has not. And as far as she's concerned, this is a war of orthodoxy against the Antichrist, which is, after all, you know, what could be more rock and roll than a line like that? What else? Then another interesting one is Akim Apachev, who goes by the rapper name of Gasanov, and that comes from Mariupol, the Ukrainian city that was so dramatically levelled in the invasion. Now, he served as one of these military correspondents, Voyenkori, in both the Donbass and Syria. And he's behind such feats of music, shall we call them, as Summer and Crossbows, which became very popular amongst the Russian mercenaries. And also, interestingly, his own version of a song called They Are Gone, which actually was originally written by a Chechen who had fought against Moscow in both of the Chechen wars, and actually dedicated that song to the jihadist rebels who had died in those wars, and in fact was banned as an extremist since, I think it was in 2013. Anyway, what happened is Gasanov, Apachev, rewrote the song in memory of those fallen in the Donbass wars. And in fact, it was actually played at the funeral of the military blogger Vladlen Tatarsky, who, if people recall, was killed by a bomb that was sort of smuggled in, almost certainly as part of a plot by HUR, Ukrainian military intelligence. And in the music video of his song We, Gasanov and his mates compare themselves to Ivan the Terrible's Aprichniki, the sort of black-clad, thuggish bodyguards come raiders who particularly sort of carried out these astonishingly cruel reprisals against anyone whom the increasingly paranoid Tsar regarded as enemies. And the interesting thing is that amongst those who participated in this video, there was the aforementioned Vladlen Tatarsky, but there was also the actor whose name now suddenly escapes me, Akhlabistin. Anyway, Ivan Akhlabistin, who also at another point in a fairly obvious little sort of PR move, stood in Red Square and shouted, Goida! Which was a cry that the Aprichniki used to, in a way, signal and start some particular one of their various vicious reprisals. Although Akhlabistin says, no, it had nothing to do with the Opritchniki. But in circumstances, I'm willing to suggest that there was a connection. So it is clear that there is a new generation of rising cultural figures who are associated with the war and this whole mobilisation effort at the very time when it looks that there's a purge of the older generation of cultural icons and anyone who's not willing to cooperate. So we have, for example, the past her sell-by date, Alla Pugacheva, who nonetheless still is very important, as again, one of the voices of particularly of the Perestroika era, and there's talk of her being branded as a foreign agent. There is the for me, deeply grotesque Philip Kirkorov, now having to continue to dress in sackcloth and ashes after his infamous participation in the sort of the almost naked party in December that triggered a big sort of cultural backlash against what's deemed to be a self-satisfied cultural elite. Yuri Shevchuk, in his legendary band DDT, have announced that basically their concerts are being postponed indefinitely for reasons, quote unquote, beyond the musician's control. So there is this sense that a sort of space is being created for a new cultural elite, which frankly also intersects with a new business elite. I mean, for example, Timati, who's generally regarded as a pro-Putin rapper, but the very least can be said not to have gone against the regime. You know, he also snapped up and rebranded hundreds of branches of Starbucks and Domino's pizza stores across the country. So this is it. If you are in good with the regime, then who knows what other opportunities arise. And let's be honest, not least, as so many of the old sort of school figures have left the country or have become labelled foreign agents, whether we're talking about rappers like Oxymiron or Noise MC, modern icons like Zemfira or Manitochka, or indeed, absolute legends like Boris Grebenshikov, who's the founder and lead singer of Aquarium, one of the groups that absolutely provided the soundtrack for Perestroika. It is clear that there is that sense of I don't want to call it a cultural revolution, because that implies a lot more kind of grassrootsness to it, and also that it is a little bit more sort of dramatic than it really is. But I think it's fair to say an attempt by the Kremlin to create a deliberate cultural renovation in its own favour. And this isn't just about music. There was a wonderful thing about Putin demanding that officials work out how to produce games consoles built in Russia for Russians in 5 months. Because after all, as we all know, that's how quickly it goes. Because of a reflection of the fact that Russians play, like everyone else, a lot of video games. I think 23% of Russians regularly play video games. And so what Putin is concerned about, and he actually said this, is that basically video games should become instruments of patriotism. What he said was this: the game should help a person develop, help him find himself, should help educate a person both within the framework of universal human values and within the framework of patriotism. Now, look, video games have long been regarded as instruments for some form of indoctrination. Why do you think, for example, that the US military is so assiduous in supporting video games that exalt the US military? Because, and indeed are willing to actually field sort of their own teams in sort of video games tournaments. It's because this is actually a useful way of shaping people's perspectives and think, yes, the American army is the best and therefore why shouldn't I join? So, let's not be too naive about this. But what's interesting is precisely when you do have a massive market inside Russia and one increasingly that, again, is being abandoned by Western companies. Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, they've all stopped supplying their products to Russia and closing their online stores to users from Russia. I dare say people have found all kinds of workarounds. But again, actually, the risk is what happens is we find ourselves surrendering this market to the propagandists, and they are going to take advantage of it. How well they do is another matter, because, we can look, for example, at what's happened in film as an interesting example of both how opportunities arise, but quite often get fumbled by heavy-handed political hackery. Now, film is, after all, long been, from the very beginning, a very powerful part of agitprop, agitation propaganda, and the Bolsheviks understood this perfectly well, and so too, at least in theory, today's propagandists do. They realise it's important. It's not so clear if they realise just quite how they can mobilise it. And this is a big industry. And it's not just that there are thousands of cinemas around the country. And in fact, people going to cinemas, the figures have actually increased. In 2023, the audience is more than doubled compared to 2021. So in 2 years, it went up to 90 million people. But then there's also the huge and growing online and streaming audience. So in that context, no wonder people look to cinema. But what's happened is that attempts to basically use presidential administration money, and certainly presidential administration patronage, to sponsor a whole new genre of patriotic film is frankly not doing too well. And the particularly striking example was Russia's first film about the current war in Ukraine. I mean, there are films that I've mentioned about the earlier stages of the conflict, but this current war has really flopped. And this film is called The Witness, Svidetel, and it basically hits every single propaganda talking point that you would expect with an astonishing lack of subtlety. The idea is that this film is about this fictional Belgian violinist called Daniel Cohen, who comes to Kyiv in February 2022, just shortly before the invasion. And as the special military operation begins, Cohen gets caught up in all of this and witnesses all sorts of terrible crimes and provocations by Ukrainian nationalists. So you've got a point where you've got a Ukrainian commander with a copy of Mein Kampf and others pledging their allegiance to Nazism and Hitler. All these kind of things. People talking about the basically attempt to genocide the Russian-speaking population of the Donbass, blah, blah, blah. And so he sets out to try and tell the world the truth about what's going on, and hence that he is a witness. Now, massive levels of support from the system. A budget of 200 million rubles. I mean, that's £1.5 million, which is not very much. But bear in mind the ruble and the pound, you know, those rubles buy you a lot more. So, but nonetheless, think of it this way. They spent 200 million rubles on this film. And what did they manage to gross in the earliest, period of the release? Less than 14 million rubles. And there are all kinds of examples of people posting on social media pictures of empty cinema theatres. The point is that the cinemas were obliged to make showings, but unfortunately for them, Russians were not obliged to actually go and watch the damn thing. So that was an embarrassing flop. But the trouble is, it's actually only the most recent of a whole bunch of new mobilization films. So you've heard of B-movies. Well, these are Z-movies. And some of them are not bad in their own terms. And I'm not making this about the propaganda behind them, but just simply as films. Many of them really aren't. So, back in 2019, for example, there was the film Donbass, Ukraine, which, again, tries to basically present the situation of evil Ukrainians shelling and killing ordinary Russians, forcing people to... Sorry, I'm going to say Russians, I mean Russian speakers, sorry. In the Donbass, who forcing them to basically take up arms against them. Even Russian critics panned it. It was so heavy-handed, bad scripts. To call the characters two-dimensional is toponymically generous. I mean, really bad. And how many people went to see this? 47,000 people bothered to go and see this. Now, there's others that perhaps are a little bit more imaginative. I mean, there's the film Apolchinochka, which literally means like militia girl, apolchensi, being the term that was used for the fighters of the Donbass and the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics. And this, which came out in, 2019, It was about three women fighting in the militia of the Luhansk People's Republic. And again, it was all about the fact that they've been driven to it by the evil Ukrainians and the Ukro-fascists and so forth. This is, I suppose, equal opportunity toxic nationalism. But at least this did have a little bit more variety in the nature of the characters. Then there are some which actually sort of have a much more sort of broad intent of propaganda. 2021, for example, there was this film Saltsepyok, which kind of means it's actually a hard one to translate. I've seen it as hot sunlight, but the point is, hardly coincidentally, it is also Saltsepyok is also the nickname for a Russian fuel air explosive rocket launcher, which the Russians claim the Ukrainians use against them, but in fact, it's very, very clear that the Russians use against the Ukrainians. And once again, it's about what happened in 2014, an attempt to try and create the situation that, you know, the perspective rather, that the Ukrainians started this conflict in the first place, that Russians who happened to be Ukrainian citizens were absolutely the victims, that they pushed back against intolerable oppression, and that therefore it's entirely moral, right and proper to support them. And in fact, it fits into a longer political tradition, which, you know, very much evokes what happens during the Great Patriotic War and such like. Again, a really awful film. Not like, for example, you know, the series of films that were produced by and for supporting the Wagner mercenary organisation. Though, actually, most of the films I've mentioned, like them, were actually produced by Paritet Film and then distributed by Aurus Distributors, which were two companies that Yevgeny Prigozhin, the late lamented of Wagner fame, actually was a major backer. But the point is, you know, whereas the films that Prigozhin wanted made about Wagner, like The Tourist, again, they may well be ideologically, let's call them problematic. But actually, as kind of slam-bam action films, they are not terrible. They're not great, absolutely, and don't feel that this is an encouragement for you to go and watch them. But they're not absolutely awful. What's striking, though, is that that's, as it were, the real commercial sector. But these ones that are clearly much more being sort of thrown together by a committee of people associated with the presidential administration are really bad films that no one really wants to watch. What do they want to watch? They want to watch Barbie. I mean, this is a fascinating thing. The very time that these propaganda films are bombing, if you'll excuse the pun, what you see are Russians flocking to see Barbie, which is not legally available in Russia. But nonetheless, all kinds of bootleg copies are being screened, sometimes at pop-up cinemas, sometimes actually in real cinemas. You actually have a sort of the official film that's on, and Barbie also being run, sort of tacked on to the end. And people are rushing to that. Even though, interestingly enough, even the Kremlin is deeply unhappy about this, because it feels that Barbie is not the kind of cultural icon that it wants the new Spartans of Russia to be sort of identifying with. And in fact, the culture ministry is now refusing even to allow pirate copyrights, because they say the film is not in line with the goals set by our president to strengthen the spiritual and traditional values of our citizens. Russians don't seem to care. And in fact, even if you think of Barbie and think, well, okay, that is, after all, an American cultural / consumer icon, you can't really challenge the nationalist credentials of Cheburashka. It's another new film, again, a children's one, even though a lot of adults have been watching it and enjoying it, featuring Cheburashka, who, if you know, it's very much, it's hard to quite describe. It's, if you imagine a big-eared bear thing, that was in some ways the 1960s Soviet answer to Mickey Mouse. So terribly well known from a puppet series that Russians would have seen in their youth and can continue to watch on, you know, YouTube or whatever else. And Russians have been flocking to see a new Cheburashka film, even though it's apparently pretty sort of childish. You know, it's a fairy tale comedy for, you know, family viewing. I haven't seen it, I will confess. But nonetheless, it was released on the 1st of January 2023. And, you know, by the 10th of January, it had become the highest grossing Russian film ever made. And as of January 13, the film outperformed Avatar. You remember the 2009 Blue Aliens thing? I didn't like it myself, but there you go. You know, so it outgrossed those, though admittedly in ruble terms. So it actually is making a huge amount of money. It has continued not just viewing, but reviewing. And Cheburashka has continued. I mean, let's be honest, this is a figure who, you know, most people know, have sort of, you know, most Russians have steeped in their bones, not just because of the cartoon, but also because it's become something of a national symbol. In 2004, Cheburashka was the mascot of the Russian Olympic team. You can still buy all kinds of Cheburashka merchandise around, including some which are interestingly ironic. I still regret not getting a T-shirt I once saw which had Cheburashka in a beret and carrying a Kalashnikov. And of course, it was labelled Cheburashka. Che Guevara, get it? So, you know, and Russians understand this, but also it's a simple, basic, undemanding, and above all, feel-good film. And Mikhail Zigar, always a very, very well-informed and astute observer of the Russian psyche, said, "The popularity of Cheburashka is not faked. It's an objective reality, one of the few indisputable indicators that can shed light on the true mood in Russia. They don't want to hear anything about the war. They don't want to be proud of someone else's victories. They are so tired and scared that they are ready to sit in the dark cinema and cry with compassion for imaginary little-eared beast. They want their childhood back so they can decide nothing and be responsible for nothing." And if that were not enough of an encomium to Cheburashka and what he, it, and Barbie represent, it's worth noting that Alexander Dugin, yes, Alexander Dugin, Putin's brain, of course he's not, and the usual sort of zeitgeist-chasing so-called philosopher of Russian nationalism, is, of course, deeply opposed. What did he say? "We don't need Cheburashka. This is some kind of weak-mindedness. With Cheburashka, we won't win." Indeed, he actually went on to say that Cheburashka is not some kind of innocent little cartoon character. Oh, no. I'd love this. "I did a special study on the metaphysics of Cheburashka, and I realized it's about a demon of the moon called, and I will stumble on this, Sherd Barsheot Sher Tatan." Of course it is. But here's the point, look. If we look also at, for example, the declining viewing figures of the television news, or indeed of these toxic geopolitical talk shows where a succession of opportunists and nationalists scream at each other, trying to outdo everyone else in blaming MI6 for everything that goes wrong and so forth, it is clear that Russians, it's not just that they don't necessarily buy the message that the Kremlin is peddling in terms of the specifics of what's going on in the world and what's going on in Ukraine. It's more that they do not want to be dragged into this hyper-militarized, hyper-paranoid, hyper-nationalistic mindset that Kirienko and co. are trying to impose upon them. So yes, of course, they may well enjoy Shaman's, you know, high-octane, over-the-top lyrics. Or they may well actually enjoy some of the films that emerge. Though probably they're more interested in the historical ones that are pegged to things like the Great Patriotic War and the like, rather than the here and now. They may well end up playing, quote-unquote, patriotic video games. But ultimately, they are able to disconnect themselves from the message that is meant to impose upon them. Remember, Russians have this long experience of being exposed to propaganda and understanding what they need to say in public while still believing what they believe in private. So, it's not exactly rock and roll, is it? But nonetheless, you clearly have, through music, through film, through television, through other forms of art as well, an attempt at imposing a new cultural identity on Russians. And Kirienko's got a lot of money he's willing to throw at it. But I'm not ultimately convinced that he can buy his way to victory in this culture war. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.